This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 304 was recorded on December 30th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy New Year. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. GavCal Research founder Louis Vincent Gav returns as 2021's final feature interview guest. We'll discuss the big picture of where the world of macro stands and what lays ahead in 2022.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get into that S&P 500. It broke to fresh new highs at the start of the week and is holding it up till now. What's your take on the market? Is there more upside from here?
Well, Patrick, since this is the last market wrap of the year, let's take a step back and I'll take everything from a slightly longer term perspective. And just to put this whole equity market in long term perspective, we've had an equity market that for the last 10 years has completely defied gravity and defied the amazement of a lot of people, myself included. And it seems like central bank stimulus is going to keep cranking asset prices higher. So I think there's plenty of that still to come. Now, meanwhile, the Fed has kind of painted themselves into a corner in the sense that they've made this announcement that they're really serious about tapering stimulus. And if they really do that, that presumably spells some real difficulty for the stock market until they change their mind again. And I think the market is looking past all of that. So as far as what comes up next, I think the Omicron panic is fully retraced out of the market, but it might get put back into the market because we're right at the point where exponential arithmetic tends to defy human expectations. We're about to see that huge explosion of Omicron cases. We've had it in the last couple days. It's going to get much worse in the next couple of weeks, and it's probably going to freak a bunch of people out. So far, the market seems to be correctly discounting that despite the very high case count, we're going to have much lower hospitalization and death rates, and Omicron is not going to be as big of a deal as it's first going to seem like. But I think that potential for the market to get spooked lower over the next couple of weeks as we see some really big case numbers in headlines scaring people, and probably the media not doing their job and putting it in context and explaining that, hey, it's a completely different story this time in terms of hospitalization rate and death rate. As far as where we go after the whole Omicron thing is worked out of the system, I think it really depends on central bank policy. And at the end of 2022, we may see a change in the power structure in the government, and that may have effect on where we go with who the next Fed chairman is and so on and so forth. So I think it's mostly going to be about Fed stimulus for the next several years, and we'll see how it plays out.
Eric, the U.S. dollar really has stayed in a very tight trade range over the last month, and nothing big's happening. Do you think there's a big move coming in the new year?
Well, Patrick, the old saying is the longer the base, the higher in space. So the longer we see this consolidation play out, the more likely it is that we'll have a larger move ultimately. But, you know, at this point, there's nothing to do but wait and see until we get either a daily close below 95.5 or above 97. That would be an indication we're starting to break out of the trading range. Till then, we're consolidating. There's nothing else to say.
Eric, let's talk crude oil. When you did this interview with Louis, which was very bullish on oil, it was before the breakout that happened in the last week. But really here, we got this big surge higher, almost $10 in just over a week towards $77 on that February contract. What's in store for oil from here?
Well, of course, I'm kicking myself, Patrick, because this is exactly what I expected would eventually happen. I think we're headed much higher on crude oil prices in the new year, and I think we'll hit $100 before 2022 is over. The thing is, the reason I actually stepped out of this market temporarily is I do still think that there is a risk that everybody is going to freak out just a little bit too much in the next 2 weeks when Omicron case counts go just crazy off the charts. It's going to freak people out. We're at the point where exponential arithmetic and human nature just don't mix and people get freaked out. At the same time, I think the market is correctly waking up to the reality that no matter how bad the case count is, even if the whole world gets this thing, this really is the bad cold that is nothing worse than a bad cold for most people who don't have severe comorbidities. It's really nowhere close to as dangerous as the earlier waves, and it's not going to lead to the hospitalization rates. That means governments should not be doing any border closures, and it should not affect demand for crude oil and other products. The thing is, what governments should do and what governments do are two different things. And I still think there is a risk of the Omicron freakout taking us to unnecessarily conservative measures imposed by governments. Let's see what happens. But so far, the way this is playing out is the market is waking up and realizing that Omicron's not a big deal. And I think that we're headed back towards the 80s and then eventually much higher on crude oil prices. As far as inventory this week, crude oil drew down 3.6 million barrels. Great big bullish print there. Cushing, Oklahoma building 1.1 million barrels. And again, more bullish prints on the finished products with both gasoline and distillates drawing down significantly. 1.5 million barrels of gasoline and 1.7 million barrels of distillates, while U.S. production ticked up 200,000 barrels to 11.8 million barrels.
Eric, gold has temporarily dipped below 1,800 and then immediately recovered back up, continues to hold above there. Is this the moment where gold finally starts a new bull trend?
Well, Patrick, the gold chart looks pretty good, but how many times have we said that in the past on this program, and then it turned out to not look so good a week later? Right now, we have moved above all of the short-term moving averages. That's a good sign. Means maybe a new bull trend is in play. The thing is, we're only a couple of dollars above the five-day moving average, which is at 1810. We need to stay above the five-day at 1810, and it will actually drift higher over the next few days. The next levels that I'm watching after that are 1833 and 1879. If we can clear those, then the bull trend is really on. Looks good now, but you know, we've had a lot of false starts. Let's see how this plays out.
Eric, the 10-year yield's been stuck in a range between 140 and 150 basis points, but a little bit of a pop yesterday as we got up to about 155. You think it's a new breakout out of that trade range?
Well, Patrick, I think the market is still trying to digest monetary policy. Is the Fed really serious about tapering? How long are they going to stay the course on tapering before they change their tune when the market goes sideways on them? How long is it going to take before the market does go sideways on them? I think we're trying to figure all this stuff out. And as far as I can tell, as long as we stay below 1.70 on the 10-year yield, nobody's getting too upset yet. I think we're still well within the trading range. So maybe we're in an expanded trading range now, but I think it's still within the range.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is GavCal Research co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Eric, why did we invite Louis back on the show this week?
Patrick, it's our last podcast of the calendar year, and I wanted to get a expert guest who really has a big picture perspective, who can step back and not talk to us about, you know, what's going on this week or next week in the market, but where do we stand at 2 years into this pandemic in the global macro big picture of things? Where are we headed? What lies ahead in 2022? And boy, who better than Louis Vincent Gav, co-founder of GavCal, perhaps one of the most respected institutional advisory firms in the industry, to give us that year-end perspective. So I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Well, Eric's interview with Louis is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon.
Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is GavCal co-founder Louis Vincent Gav. Louis, it's great to have you back on the show. I want to start with the big picture of where we stand in markets. Seems like the recovery was on, and then we got the Omicron scare. I don't know what your take is, but I've been looking at the data, and as far as I can see, it's going to be a while before the death toll climbs above zero. I don't think this is really the problem that the White House would like to make it out to be for some reason. What do you think is going on here, and what does it mean for markets?
Hey, you know, roll out the usual suspects, right? We've had really a few ugly weeks, right? You've got energy down 20%. I think last I checked, the Russell 2000 growth was had basically given up all of its gains for the year and was roughly flat for the year. I think you got Bitcoin that more or less lost a quarter of its value. And I think behind all this, you've had a lot of things get slaughtered, right? A lot of former, you know, beloved names of the general public, whether your Zoom videos, your Beyond Meats, your PayPals, your Spotify's, your Mercado Libres, or your Alibaba's or Pinduoduo. It's been a bit of a bloodbath. You know, you feel a little bit like, you know, wheel out the usual suspects, right? So you've got, you know, COVID, Omicron as a potential suspect. You obviously have, you know, Fed sounding more hawkish as another potential suspect. And then you have, continued China slowdown and Evergrande finally, you know, slowest moving bankruptcy in the history of slow moving bankruptcies, sort of hitting the wall again. So, you know, I think you can find quite a few usual suspects. The reality, though, perhaps the simplest explanation is you had a lot of things that were priced for perfection, and perfection is a hard status to achieve. So if you look at a lot of the things that got absolutely smoked, it's a lot of things that were, you know, frankly, really, really punchily valued. And again, that only works, you know, if you buy things that are massively overvalued, that can only work for so long. Meanwhile, you know, if you look at the Russell 2000 value, it's still up double digit for the year. And the correction has been nowhere near as bad as the Russell 2000 growth. So I think for me, the interesting question is, all right, is the sort of massive growth bubble that we've experienced really since the start of COVID, is it now running out of steam? And I think the answer is, you know, and I don't think that's linked to COVID. I don't think that's linked to China. I think the answer to that is linked to your view of Fed policies as you look ahead. You know, if you think Fed continues to inject tons of money into the system, then there's no reason to think the growth bubble rolls over. If you think, okay, you know, 2022 will be most likely a year where markets, where Fed starts reining stuff in, but also possibly where market starts pricing in a post-2022 environment of just less of marginally more fiscal restraint. You know, if you assume that the Democrats are going to get a walloping in November, which seems to be on the cards, then do we have an environment like we did from 2010 to 2016 where a Republican Congress just refused to expand spending? So then you move from an environment of super easy fiscal, super easy money to marginally harder money and definitely tighter fiscal. And yeah, that's all of a sudden, maybe all the very expensive stuff starts to struggle. I think that's where we are.
Well, Louis, the Fed says they're serious this time about tapering and reducing their balance sheet and so forth. Why would we believe that this time?
Yeah, you know what? I feel a little bit like when I tell off my teenage boys. It's like, come on, guys. You know, this time I mean it. And I think I've said it too many times for them to take me seriously. The reality, I'm sort of – actually, let me backtrack a second, Eric. Because, you know, I think the last time you and I spoke, you know, we were talking about inflation. And it was, you know, I think it was it was probably 9 months ago. And – I made the case for much stronger, much higher inflation. Now, the interesting thing is, if we look at this year that we've just had, you know, starting this time last year, consensus was for 2.5% inflation. We ended up having 6%. Now, if this time last year you thought, you know what, we're going to have 2.5% inflation, you would have thought, therefore, bond yields aren't going to move very much. Therefore, the U.S. dollar will probably stay well bid. And therefore, U.S. growth stocks will continue to outperform. And lo and behold, we had 6% inflation. The U.S. dollar stayed well bid. U.S. treasuries haven't done very, have been fine. And U.S. growth stocks have massively outperformed. So, you know, inflation was a massive surprise, but it had no impact on the markets. Didn't impact the bond market, didn't impact the currency market, didn't impact the stock market. And I think the reason for that is pretty simple, is that the markets fundamentally don't really care about macro. They care about the policy environment. So they care about how perhaps the macro might impact the policies. But, you know, this past year, 2021, was a year where you had accelerating inflation and yet the Fed kept doing QE. You had accelerating inflation and that yet the US government kept talking about spending even more money and growing even bigger budget deficits than it was doing. So the markets responded to this, not to the inflation data. They thought, hey, we got easy fiscal, easy money. Now, as we project ourselves forward, that's indeed the big question for 2022, is we've had a big divergence between market performance and the macro because on a policy front, policy stayed the same. I know the macro changed, but policy stayed exactly the same. In 2022, do we get the policy change? The Fed says we will. I'm doubtful. I actually think the more important policy change will come in 2023, and it'll be on the fiscal side. We'll basically get another Tea Party Congress that will freeze government spending. But you know, as you look forward to 2022, I think what you have is a Biden administration that will try to spend as much money as possible to try to save its electoral result on the one hand, and on the other, that will sort of prevent the Fed from tightening too much. And here I know you have my friend Luke Groman often on the program, and you know I sort of agree with him that it's very hard for the Fed to tighten meaningfully, because if they do, they risk creating a bond market meltdown, which you know would have an impact on equity prices and would have an impact on real estate. And given you know how important asset prices are to the U.S. economy, the Fed wouldn't be able to stay very tight very long. So yeah, sure, at the margin they'll move a little bit on the tighter side, but let's not kid ourselves that they're ever going to get ahead of this inflation curve for a very simple reason, and that is that inflation is not a bug. Inflation is the feature. You know, every policymaker everywhere in the world is following inflationary policies because fundamentally that's what they want. They want the inflation to deal with the big government debt problem because that's how you deal with it. So, you know, we're always going to have monetary policy that's way behind the curve. Again, that's not a bug, it's the feature.
Let's talk about where this goes, because there are a lot of people who hold this opinion that, the Fed's arms are going to be tied here. Their hands are going to be tied behind their back because we're going to get to this situation of inflation that they won't be able to fight by raising interest rates. Is that a real concern? Is it really true that there's a trap there, or can they just let inflation run hot?
Well, to be honest, that's the debate, as you point out, that everybody's having, and I think the answer will lie not with the Fed, but with energy. You know, the reality is most economic activity is energy transformed in one way or the other, and you know the big difference between say the 1940s, 1950s, and the 1970s was the difference in energy. You know, in the 40s and 50s, the Fed did keep interest rates very low. They basically did yield curve control. Real interest rates were massively negative. And that's how the U.S. got out of its massive debt situation by, in essence, spoiling bondholders over the course of a generation. In real terms, bondholders lost 60% of their net worth through the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And in the 70s, what shifted, why it got nasty, was that energy prices went through the roof. Because through the 40s and 50s and 60s, energy prices were very low, very cheap, very stable. So I would say that, you know, as you look at this environment of, you know, tight labor force, of supply chain dislocations, of rising prices everywhere, as you project yourself forward, and at the same time, very easy monetary policies and very easy fiscal policies, as you project yourself forward, you know, if you think that we're going to enter a new golden era of cheap and plentiful energy, thanks to all the investments we've made in solar and in wind and elsewhere, and that these investments really start to pay off, then I don't think you need to worry too much. Yes, we'll have real interest rates in negative territory, but the environment will be very similar to what we had in the 40s and 50s, and basically government debt will be taken care of over time. If on the flip side you think, hold on, we're entering into a period of energy stress because, you know, for the past few years we've spent all the money that we were going to invest in energy investing in wind and solar, and these aren't giving us the kind of returns on investments that were hoped for, and we haven't invested enough in natural gas, we haven't invested enough in oil, you know, the inventories are low everywhere around the world. So we're entering into an energy crisis. So, you know, energy prices are going to spike up. Then the inflation story gets a whole lot nastier, a whole lot quicker. And it gets nasty, perhaps not on the policy front, but on the politics front, where, you know, you start to see populists be elected because, you know, rising energy prices usually means rising food prices. And, you know, having high energy and high food is a very tough backdrop for any policymaker to run for re-election. So then you start seeing, you know, bad electoral outcomes, I don't know, in France, in Italy, or elsewhere. So, you know, for me, the big linchpin in 2022 will very much be energy. I happen to be an energy bull. I think we've set ourselves up for a big energy squeeze. So I think that's our outlook for 2022. If I'm wrong, however, if, you know, the energy situation isn't as dire as I fear it to be, then policymakers won't have to worry about the higher inflation.
Well, unfortunately, Louis, I am in strong agreement. I think that the final years of the era of oil will be defined by very, very expensive oil, not by cheap oil, the way a lot of people are assuming. And I say that because we've completely stopped making investments in new exploration and production for oil. And yeah, we're going to phase it out. That is a good idea. That is the right plan, but it's not going to happen overnight. And we are phasing out oil faster than we're phasing in its replacements. And I think it's going to lead to some really serious problems.
I think it's actually worse than that, Eric. If I may, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
I think it's worse than you think. You know, we'll have an argument about this.
Well, let me tell you how I look at energy very briefly. You know, for me, there's really, if I look at the past 20 years, there's really two different periods. There's a 2000 to 2015, and then there's a 2015 to COVID. Basically, you know, 2000 to 2015, the world goes from using 400 exajoules a year to 500 exajoules a year. And out of that 500, 61 come from China. And out of that 61 from China, 51 come from coal. Meanwhile, there's basically no increase in the consumption of energy from 2000 to 2015 across the OECD. So basically what happened between 2000 and 2015, to cut a very long story short, is that the world decided, you know what, I still want to consume a lot of these, you know, goods, but I'm going to outsource the production to China. And China's going to produce them, not with expensive natural gas or not with expensive oil or expensive nuclear, but China's going to produce them by using very cheap coal, because coal is much cheaper than anything else. You know, if it wasn't so darn polluting, we'd be using nothing but coal. It's easy to move. It's cheap to move. It's easy to exploit. And there's so much of it around the world. So what happened between 2000 and 2015 is basically half of the world's increase in energy supply was done by Chinese coal. And at the cost of just enormous environmental devastation in China. You know, you were spending time there at the time, so was I. And then in 2015, China basically says, you know what, I'm done. You know, I've got babies dying of asthma. I can't do this anymore. And since then, coal use in China has flatlined. Now, we were saved because in 2015, the US oil and shale gas boom kicks in. So the US moves from 5.5 million barrels per day to 13 million barrels per day. And instead of using Chinese coal, we use US natural gas and US oil. But that boom is now over, because that boom was massively capital intensive. In fact, it was capital destructive. More than $300 billion were destroyed in the shale oil patch. It was massively destructive. And that brings us to today. Now, you know, COVID has set us back in terms of global energy use. But if we think that by 2022, 2023, you know, we'll be roughly back to normal in terms of global travel, in terms of everything else, then basically that means that between now and the end of 2023, the world will need to produce an additional 50 or 60 hexajoules, knowing that it won't come from Chinese coal and knowing that it won't come from the US oil patch. So where's it going to come from? The answer is, I don't know. But I think that's problematic.
Louis, since we're on China, I want to broaden that conversation and talk a little bit more about what happens after the intense COVID crisis that we're in kind of passes. Because before COVID, we had President Trump in negotiations with Xi around an economic deal that was sort of starting to come together. And of course, now we have a new administration. What is going to happen between the U.S. and China? And what is it going to mean both geopolitically and for markets in the aftermath of COVID, when we start to ask questions about who was responsible for this and whether or not China withheld information that they shouldn't have withheld and so forth?
You know, the honest answer is I don't know. Here's what I do know. What I do know is that for my whole career, up until very recently, Chinese policymaking was driven first and foremost by the need to create jobs, right? It's for a very simple reason. You had roughly 20 million people that were leaving the farm every year to move into cities. And with this kind of demographic shift, I think if you were a Chinese policymaker, every morning you woke up thinking, you know, how am I going to absorb these 20 million guys? And so all your policy was driven towards that. That's why every time you had a slowdown, whether it was in 2003 with SARS or in 2008 with the mortgage crisis or 2015, each time you had a slowdown, the Chinese government would step on the gas. It would tell its banks to lend. It would add infrastructure spending. It would add excess capacity onto excess capacity. Because the number one government priority for the past 25 years was creating jobs. Now, have you noticed, of course, that I'm sure you have, that China's been slowing down hard, that real estate has been face planting? And have you noticed that this time around, there is no government stimulus, right? There's no government pressure on the banks to go out to lend. There's no adding excess capacity on top of excess capacity. And I think the reason for that is twofold. First, the job imperative has disappeared. You know, up until 5, 6, 7 years ago, the workforce in China just demographically was still growing by about 10 million people a year. Last year, China lost 3 million workers. By 2025, China will be losing 7 million workers. By 2030, it'll be losing 10 million workers every year. So, you know, the need to create jobs is no longer there. You know, so that's the first big shift. The second big shift is the perception that the U.S. is out to get them. And here I'd ask you, Eric, to put yourself into Xi Jinping's shoes. And I think you and I have discussed this before, but if you're Xi Jinping, the most traumatic event of the past few years isn't COVID, and it's definitely not Evergrande. The most traumatic event of recent years is Huawei. You know, Huawei was your industrial pride and joy. It was the first time China had a genuine global brand, and it was the first time that China had a company that was taking on Western companies and winning market share at the very pinnacle of technology. And the US comes in and destroys that. It destroys it in 3 months. Now, you might say, well, you know, that was Trump doing Trumpian things, and now with a more normal administration, things should get back on track. But the reality is, if there's one constant between the Trump White House and the Biden White House, it's in the China policy. Just a few weeks ago, you had Gina Raimondo, the U.S. Commerce Secretary, come out and during a press conference say that it is U.S. policy to slow down China's rate of innovation. Now, granted, this might be U.S. policy, but I would think that's the part you don't say out loud, right? I mean, to come out and publicly say, you know, our goal is to slow down China's rate of innovation. I mean, if you're China and you're on the other side, you think, oh, okay, well, good to know. Now I have to cushion myself against potential U.S. attacks. And here, China has three major vulnerabilities. Its dependence on foreign semiconductor is one. Its dependence on foreign energy is another. But its biggest weakness by far is its dependence on the U.S. dollar. The fact that all of China's trade is denominated in U.S. dollars. And by the way, look at right now, you know, in these Ukraine-Russia tensions, what is the U.S. threatening Russia with? To kick Russia out of the SWIFT system, right? I mean, that's the sort of no pun intended, the trump card in the U.S. deck, that they can always kick somebody out of the international financial system. So if you're China, you think, okay, that's the part I need to address. And so policy shifts from creating jobs at any cost to having a strong currency, because the only way you can de-dollarize your trade is if the renminbi is stronger than the dollar. And so you have the situation, as we've seen in the past 18 months, where in spite of China having by far the worst stock market of anywhere in the world, in spite of China being basically the only place in the world where growth has been massively disappointing, well, against this backdrop, the renminbi is actually the world's strongest currency, which is pretty much the opposite of what every China bear thought, right? Every China bear thought, oh, China's going to slow down and the renminbi will go down massively. Well, no, because now the onus of policy is no longer job creation. The onus of policy is have a strong currency. And, you know, we're all the fruits of our own experiences. I'm French. I grew up in France. And for me, and I'm sorry to be long-winded about this, but, you know, for me, when I was growing up in France, I started in the 90s in the financial world, and I worked for a French bank called Paribas. And at the time, French policymakers had decided that we needed to create the euro and that there was nothing more important than the French franc being on a par with the Deutschmark, and that anything would be sacrificed on the altar of that goal. And so if that meant that French industry would be destroyed, then so be it. If that meant that, you know, Paris real estate went down 50%, then so be it. And if that meant the Crédit Lyonnais would have to go bust and Paribas would have to be merged, then so be it. This is where you are in China today. In China today, the goal, the policy goal has shifted from create jobs to needing a strong currency, which is why the Chinese bond market, government bond market, is the world's best performing bond market, just like the French, Italian, and Spanish bond markets were the best performing asset classes in the 1990s. And so the policy settings in China today, again, you take your playbook from Europe in the 90s, and that's where you are. Now, what this means concretely is that if you expect a strong dollar in 2022, then that means that China's ability to ease will be very limited because they need the renminbi to be strong against the dollar. If like me, so if you think, oh, the Fed is going to get ahead of this curve, they're going to tighten and they're going to put the inflation cat back in the bag, and you know, and you should expect a much stronger dollar from here. You know, if that's your scenario, then don't expect any stimulus in China. If, however, like me, you believe, you know what, in 2022 the Fed will be a day late and a dollar short all the time. They're always, you know, they're not going to tighten very much because frankly they can't. Then it'll mean that the U.S. dollar won't be so strong, and it'll mean that the PBOC will have more room to ease. And the way they'll ease is they'll tell the banks, hey, guys, you can make loans again. And if they can make loans again, what's going to happen is every property developer will tap credit lines and buy back debt at 40 or 50 cents on the dollar, because whatever gain you make, that 50 cents gain you make will flow straight to the earnings bottom line. So, you know, I think if you're bullish on the dollar, then you just keep on buying U.S. growth stocks and U.S. treasuries. If, like me, you're bearish on the dollar because you think the Fed won't be able to do very much, then there's a terrific opportunity in high-yield debt in China, because very soon China will be able to ease.
The opportunity is in high-yield debt in China? Elaborate.
Absolutely. Well, for the reason I highlighted, it's tomorrow, if China does start to ease because the U.S. dollar is weak and therefore they have the ability to ease, then that means every property company out there that's got a bond trading at 40 cents on the dollar will be able to get bank credit lines. And once they get the bank credit lines, they can turn around and buy back their debt. Because why wouldn't you buy back your debt that's trading at 40 or 50 cents on the dollar? It's the simplest way to repair your balance sheet, because you take, you're swapping debt for debt, except that you're booking 50 cents of profit for every dollar that you've borrowed, and that 50 cents of profit goes straight into repairing your stretched balance sheet. So I think that's a potential trade for 2022. But again, that assumes that the Fed sort of stays behind the curve. Otherwise, you'll be better off just staying in Chinese government bonds.
Louis, let's expand the conversation to include Russia, because what you've told me so far is that a lot of this is going to depend on how the energy thing goes. Well, guess what? Russia has a pretty big say in that. The other thing I can't help but observe is it seems like the U.S. is really testing both its Chinese and its Russian relationships to the point where, boy, you know, Russia and China could make a deal at some point around energy that maybe doesn't benefit the United States as much as we would like. What are the risks? What could go right? What could go wrong? And what should we be thinking about influencing that triangle of power between the United States, Russia, and China?
Well, look, I'm a bull on energy, so, you know, it's not that much of a stretch to imagine that I'd also be a big bull on Russia. And I'm a bull both for the cyclical reasons surrounding energy, but also some more structural reasons that you allude to. Look, the reality is that, you know, China and Russia are the most obvious natural trade partners in the world, right? Russia produces all the commodities that China needs, and China produces all the consumer goods and the finished goods and the capital goods that Russia needs to continue industrializing. So, you know, for them to, you know, if there's one, you know, sort of bilateral trade relationship where you can imagine that trade will continue to expand at many times the rate of GDP growth, it's got to be that one. And so, you know, the more trade you have between two countries, usually, you know, if you're a believer in Ricardian equivalency and Ricardian comparative advantages, then, you know, you got to look at it positively. But I think there's another reason, to be honest, to be bullish Russia, is that if we look at the past 15, 20 years, the reality is that China got involved in a lot of businesses that China probably shouldn't have gotten involved in the first place. Things like petrochem, things like steel, like aluminum, you know, things in which China really has no genuine comparative advantages. You know, for the steel, China would ship in the iron ore from Brazil, ship in the coking coal from South Africa or Indonesia, mix it in China, and then sell it, you know, re-export it down to Australia, for example. Now, you know, what's the reason for doing that? Why would China do that? You could say, well, they had a cheap cost of labor, but, you know, when you produce steel or aluminum or petrochems, the labor doesn't count for all that much. What they had was really the ability to pollute the hell out of their atmosphere. And again, to use very cheap domestic coal to produce cheap electricity. If you think that this thing is now gone, this ability and willingness to use cheap coal and cheap electricity, and that's now gone, then a lot of these businesses are going to go back to where they should have been in the first place. And where a lot of these businesses should be is Russia. You know, Russia has very cheap electricity because it's got hydro, it's got nuclear, it's got coal. It does still have the ability to produce, to pollute because it's such a big country. So, you know, the steel production should move to Russia. The aluminum production should move to Russia. The petrochem should move to Russia. And I think all this is going to happen over the coming sort of decade. So, no, I am very bullish on Russia. I think a lot of things are lined up. And then, you know, finally, if you look at monetary policies, Russia is one of the few places around the world where the central bank has been hawkish against inflation. You know, you've had, you know, 2-year yields have gone from 4% to 8.5% in 2021. You know, so there's room for in the future, as, you know, inflation rolls over around the world, as things slow down, there's room for Russian interest rates to go down, which is more than can be said in most countries. And as you and I both know, there are few more powerful forces, tailwinds for a bull market than falling interest rates, right? So I think there's lots of reasons to be excited about the Russian market.
Louis, you're a perfect guest to ask this because you're originally French, but you're very familiar with the American financial system. You know, I can't help but react when I hear you talk about the American government threatening that they're gonna take those stinking Russians and cut them off from our SWIFT system. Now, the American government is the only government on Earth that's arrogant enough to threaten to cut somebody off from SWIFT, a consortium that's owned in Europe. It has nothing to do with the United States. But the United States apparently thinks that it has the authority to regulate that for the whole world. And they have threatened the SWIFT consortium before that if they don't toe the line and do what the U.S. wants, that they'll be cut off from the U.S. somehow. When do we get to the point where the whole world says, you know, we've had enough of the U.S. government trying to tell everybody else what to do? We'll make it, and they've already built the replacement system for SWIFT, but we're just going to cut over and forget about SWIFT because SWIFT kowtows to the United States. We're going to use a different one that doesn't do what the U.S. wants. And we're going to let Russia and China have the trade relationship that they need, and the U.S. become secondary to all that. Needless to say, the U.S. has never liked that idea, but I wonder if we're getting closer to the day where the rest of the world says, you know, we're done letting the U.S. tell us what to do.
Look, I think that you're touching on a very important point, which is, You know, what's the U.S.'s single biggest comparative advantage? It's an interesting question. When you ask this to Americans, Americans will say, oh, you know, we have the rule of law and we have some of the world's best universities. And, you know, we have a very strong and dynamic entrepreneurial class, and all of which is true, of course. But, you know, all of which can be said of many countries. The reality is what sets the U.S. apart from anybody else, aside from the size of its military, what sets the U.S. apart from every other country out there is the fact that the U.S. has the world's reserve currency, right? That because all the global trade is denominated in U.S. dollars, or almost all global trade is denominated in U.S. dollars, the U.S., you know, when a crisis comes like 2020 or like 2008, the U.S. can basically run unlimited trade deficits and budget deficits, and in essence have those deficits funded by the rest of the world. And this is by far the U.S. biggest comparative advantage. And it's interesting because, indeed, to your point, when you ask Americans what the biggest comparative advantage of the U.S. is, they never come up with that. When you ask foreigners, that's the first thing they always fall on. It's like, oh, well, the U.S. is the U.S. dollar. You know, that's the exorbitant privilege and all that. So to your point, you know, could we ever reach a point where the U.S. basically leans too far above its skis in terms of using that exorbitant privilege? It's a very tough one to answer, to be perfectly honest. You know, the way I look at it is, you know, and I think you and I have discussed this before, but that, you know, currencies are like a computer operating system, right? I'm going to go out on a limb and bet that you use Microsoft. And the reason you use Microsoft is everybody else in finance uses Microsoft. So when you need to exchange files, or, you know, when you need to hire somebody to work with you, you can just assume that they know Microsoft. And changing systems is extremely, extremely hard. You know, to move to another system, you have to prove that the next system is better and or cheaper, and probably both. Now, when it comes to SWIFT, you know, there is no doubt that in recent years, the U.S. keeps going further and further into weaponizing the U.S. dollar, into basically telling people, look, you know, toe the line or else. And, you know, you saw the massive fines that were imposed on BNP, for example, for having the nerve to do business with Sudan, even though there were no French government sanctions against Sudan. But because the business was denominated in U.S. dollars, the BNP had to end up paying billions of dollars. I think it was like 8.2 or something, a billion-dollar fine to the U.S. government. And so, yeah, I think there is increasingly a sort of unease around the world as to how the U.S. has weaponized and keeps on weaponizing the dollar. On the flip side, you know, replacing it is a real challenge. And that's why, you know, when the U.S. government tells SWIFT, this is what you have to do, or, you know, we'll take the U.S. dollar off SWIFT, SWIFT really, you know, isn't in much of a bargaining position, right? It says, oh, okay, then I guess we have to do it. That's what China's trying to do by promoting the renminbi as a trade currency around Asia. You know, some people would argue that the solution to an always ever expanding American government is cryptocurrencies and is, you know, Bitcoin or whatever else. You know, that was the hope of Europe when they launched the euro, but that's been a dud for all the reasons that we know. So look, my point would be that if the U.S. turned around and said to Russia, okay, well, you're kicked off the SWIFT system, it's not going to trigger a collapse in the U.S. dollar immediately, but it will be one more incentive for people to look for alternatives. And that at some point you'll reach a tipping point, but I don't think we're at that tipping point.
Let's talk about precious metals, Louis. A lot of people, myself included, made a prediction. We thought that the U.S. government was likely to debase its currency with a lot of continued quantitative easing, and we got it right. And we predicted that was going to lead to a lot of inflation, and we got that right. And guess what? The next prediction was gold goes to the moon because of that, and that really hasn't happened yet. Why not, and what comes next?
So I've always looked, well, I've tended to look at gold as a play on emerging markets. And, you know, I've been bullish on gold because I've been bullish emerging markets, but I've been wrong to be bullish emerging markets. You know, the reality is if you look at gold final demand in the world today, you know, you have a big third that's in India, a small third that's in China, another 20% or so that's in the Middle East. So, you know, most of the final demand for gold happens in emerging markets. And yeah, you can, you know, you also have strong demand from places like Indonesia, Vietnam, et cetera. So what happens is, I think when emerging markets are thriving, you get strong final demand for gold, and the price goes through the roof. This is what happened in the period 2001 to 2011. During that period, emerging markets were doing very well. China was booming, and everybody was riding China's coattails. You know, in recent years, emerging markets have struggled. China has been slowing down, and there really hasn't been anybody to pick up the mantle from where China left it. You know, I think there were high hopes that you'd get strong growth from India. There were high hopes that Latin America was finally getting its act together. But you know, the news in emerging markets in the past couple of years has been tough. You know, most of them have struggled to deliver adequate COVID responses. The commodity price has been quite volatile, which is problematic for some. You've had some bad, you know, electoral outcome in others, like, you know, Chile, which had been a big success story for years. All of a sudden, there's an overcast. Again, China's been slowing down. So you put it all together, and I think that that's the main explanation for why your emerging market, your gold has done fairly little. It's, again, it's a derivative play on emerging markets. Now, I happen to be, just as I am a bear on the US dollar, I am a bull on emerging markets still. And so, you know, I own some gold, but I know why it hasn't done well, and I'm not that fussed by it.
Do you think that cryptocurrency taking market share, as more people believe that cryptocurrency is a better hedge against currency debasement, is part of it, or is that not affecting gold?
Yeah, you know, that's the big debate. The reality is cryptocurrencies are so new that it's hard to know. But I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure that it is really that much of a factor, to be honest. I know it's the go-to explanation, but I look at most of the people that I know who are trading cryptos, and, you know, very often it's like, you know, 25-year-olds and sort of younger people who don't strike me as the typical guys to buy gold. You know, I think if cryptos hadn't been invented, perhaps the mania and the bull markets on growth stocks would have gotten even crazier, because the real correlation is actually not between gold and cryptos. Increasingly, it's between gold and the NASDAQ, right? Cryptos are increasingly a sort of high beta version of the NASDAQ or of the Russell 2000 growth, partly because it's, you know, the guys who trade cryptos are the same guys who trade those meme stocks, partly because the guys who trade crypto are not doing it so much for long-term capital protection, but, you know, for sort of short-term speculative reasons, which is what happens when you have that kind of volatility. You know, I can't imagine that anybody looks at Bitcoin with the volatility that it has and thinks, you know what, I'm going to buy this because this will be good for my retirement in 20 years' time. I know it'll keep value. And maybe they are, but that seems crazy to me.
I agree on both points. They are, and it seems crazy to me too. Louis, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview, but before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you do at GalvCal Research.
We study markets. Yeah, no, we publish regularly. We're based in Hong Kong and Beijing, so we publish mostly with a strong, we publish macro research with a strong China bias. I should highlight that I've just published a new book, so I feel I should plug it. Our research tends to be for institutional investors, so it's it's sometimes too pricey for some people. But I have a new book that you can buy directly from our website, gafcal.com. The book is called Avoiding the Punch, and is really focused on basically how to build a portfolio in a new inflationary environment. So, you know, I think that book can give a good overview to people as to how we work.
Well, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value: cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was so great to have Louis back on the show. His comment on inflation and how it didn't impact the markets, and his comment was that the markets don't care about macro, that the markets care about policy. And I kind of, it struck me when he said that, and I kind of reflect on and ask the question, like, is it really that they don't care about macro, or simply in a period of financial repression, policy just dominates macro? You know, it's like one of those things that makes you think about what's this process. I mean, in the end, we are in a period of financial repression. He talked about how, you know, the debt was destroyed in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. At least debt was reset through the financial repression. And clearly, that is what was going on with these deeply negative real rates. And it's interesting that he kind of put that perspective on. And it'll be really interesting as to whether or not they'll be able to continue this over that next election period.
Well, Patrick, I agree. And I think that policy in general is going to define just about everything. I remain convinced that the reason that we have these lofty valuations and, you know, asset markets to the moon is because of central bank policy. And a lot of people, myself included, said, oh, but it's unsustainable. It can't go on indefinitely. Well, it has absolutely been proven that it can be sustained longer than we thought. And the more that I see, Patrick, the more I come to the conclusion that it really can be sustained pretty much indefinitely so long as you have a disinflationary macro backdrop. The place where you get into trouble is when you get to an inflationary or runaway inflation backdrop where suddenly central bankers' hands are tied and there's nothing that they can do. But we're years away from that still, Patrick. And until then, I think that they can get away with goosing markets higher. And that's probably what we're going to see for the next couple of years. Financial repression, as you say, is very real. Policy from both the fiscal and monetary side is going to dramatically affect markets, and there's a lot of unknowns. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the new year brings. We're going to leave it there for this week and this year, and we'll be back next week with Grant Williams joining me as our first feature interview guest of 2022. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week is a holiday shortened research roundup, which will include the transcript for today's interview. We'll be back to a normal roundup email starting next week. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K. And myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.